from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Today, we are giving the people of this country their money back.
That was House Speaker Paul Ryan just before the House vote yesterday to approve a sweeping $1.5 trillion tax overhaul that lowers the corporate tax rate, limits deductions, and leaves residents of high-tax states like California concerned about how they'll be affected. Ahead, we talk about the tax bill's impact on the people of California and its businesses and economy. And we want to hear from you. What are your tax concerns and questions? It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This morning, Congress is on the verge of approving the most sweeping tax rewrite in more than 30 years. The $1.5 trillion legislation, which passed the Senate last night and awaits a House revote this morning, cuts the corporate tax rate to 21%, removes or limits a suite of deductions, reworks individual tax brackets, and eliminates the Affordable Health Care Act's individual mandate. Supporters of the bill say it will create jobs and stimulate the economy, but critics say it will hurt the middle class and disproportionately burden high-tax states like California. This hour, we'll look at what the bill will mean for California, its residents, businesses, and economy as a whole. And joining me first to give us an update on the vote is Carolyn Lockhead, Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. And welcome, Carolyn. Good to have you back with us.
Hi, Michael.
I guess the first question is, I know the Republicans are waiting to celebrate. The champagne is about to be broken open and all of that. They're going to exult. But we have a revote. Why do we have a revote?
Well, this bill was very hastily written. It took them all of 6 weeks to, from start to finish, to get it through Congress, which is just breathtaking speed. And it got hung up in the Senate last night. Democrats challenged it under the special budget procedure and won. And so they had to drop a couple of two provisions in the title, and send it back to the House.
But its passing is a foregone conclusion, is it not?
Yes, no question about that. They have the votes.
And we'll have to wait and see what it'll mean in terms of all the promises of growth and enormous, heightened wages, everything, more jobs and everything. But here in California, there's a good deal of concern from economists of a different nature because, well, first of all, it almost seems like because California is a Democratic state, it's getting punished along with New York and New Jersey.
Well, that's certainly Governor Brown's view and also Governor Cuomo of New York and the governor of New Jersey. They really believe that this was deliberately designed to hit Democratic states on the coasts and cities in particular, which trend Democratic. And it's structured in a way that, especially with the repeal of a good bit of the SALT, state and local tax deduction, that a lot of people in California are going to pay a lot more.
It's not only deductions with respect to mortgages being limited and SALT, that is state and local taxes, but there was an article by Dan Walters in today's Sacramento Bee, or he doesn't write for the Bee anymore, I'm sorry, he's syndicated, but essentially he's saying that losing these individual federal subsidies for a state with high taxes and high local taxes is going to mean people are going to leave here. They're going to go maybe to Nevada or wherever.
Well, that's the concern. I mean, I know in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, they are worried about already high costs of housing, high costs of transportation, congestion, and it's so much cheaper to live in Nevada or Arizona that they do fear they're going to lose some of their workforces. I will say I have to – one thing that has been really, I think, underplayed in this bill is there is a – The whole structure of it is, of course, around the business taxes, especially the corporate tax cut. But for multinationals, and this was pushed very, very hard by big multinationals that have parked billions and billions of dollars overseas, including these Silicon Valley giants like Apple, is probably the most notorious. This is a huge, huge positive for them. They have wanted this for a very long time. It basically reduces, almost eliminates their taxes on overseas earnings? And it's a very large question. I mean, Republicans think that by eliminating taxes on overseas profits and slashing the corporate tax rate at home, that these companies are going to bring all that money and invest at home. That's basically the essence of their argument. But there are a lot of very smart people out there who think this is nothing but an invitation to move more investment and jobs overseas. And we'll just have to see how that plays out.
Again, it's a bet that at this point you need a crystal ball to talk about what's going to happen, all those tax havens. But it's just going to be higher taxes for people in the Golden State. I mean, it's going to be about 11% more nationally. That's what at least most economists are figuring. And I'm wondering also about something else that's not received a great deal of attention. That's the repeal of the Affordable Care Act individual mandate. There's going to be probably premiums increasing as a result. That's what the Congressional Budget Office has said, up to about 10%. And they've also said that probably 13 million people will be less insured.
Well, that's right. And California is scrambling right now to figure out what to do about that. This bill had so much in it. There was so much packed inside, including Anwar drilling, which was a 38-year battle, just, you know, basically an asterisk in this giant bill. So, yes, it has massive effects. They essentially repealed one of the main pillars of Obamacare in this legislation.
It does open Alaska National Wildlife Refuge again to oil drilling. Listeners may want to respond to that as well, but we're going to talk specifically more about the California economy and all this, and I'm wondering about one other thing, and that is possible government shutdown. There's going to be ongoing fights over DACA and over Pentagon spending. We've talked about this a good deal on the forum program. It looms pretty quickly as Friday, doesn't it?
Yeah, Friday at midnight, and they still really do not have a plan. California and hurricane disaster relief is all caught up in this fight. You got the Freedom Caucus rebelling against the disaster bill, causing all kinds of complications over in the House. Dreamers looks like it's put off till next year. There are conservative Senate Democrats that just did not want to shut down the government over this. That's kind of a loss for our Senator Kamala Harris, who's been pushing very hard on this, trying to draw a line in the sand. But I'm almost sure that that's going to be moved over to next year.
It's also, and we've talked about, of course, we'll talk about this some more, the loss of casualty deductions if there isn't a federal emergency declared. You mentioned Senator Harris. She and Senator Feinstein have both said that very plainly, those suffering wildfire victims who aren't covered in the future will not be covered, and they'll have to suffer the effects, whatever they may be. So I want to get one other thing on the table here with you, Carolyn, and that is what we can expect in terms of the political, I'm thinking about Rohrabach and Issa particularly, the only two of, 14 Republicans here in California who actually oppose this tax bill. So what about those other Republicans who are in favor of it?
Well, this has been really fascinating. I've been talking to these men and women on the Hill, and I honestly believe that they honestly believe that this is going to prove a boon to the economy. Now, there's a lot of evidence, and including major analyses, that suggest it won't be. And so this is, McConnell said last night after the vote, look, I'm happy to take this to 2018. Democrats voted against tax cuts. So that's going to be their mantra. They're going to say, oh, you voted for the status quo. But unless it produces results, and I always go back to the Obama stimulus. Remember, Republicans pretty much insisted on a tax cut as a major part of that stimulus. I don't think anybody really noticed it in their paychecks. Now, if people do not immediately notice some big bump in their paychecks, which is very unlikely because this is like 2% of your after-tax earnings spread over 52 weeks, you know, I'm not so sure people are even going to register that.
Carolyn Lockhead, again, joining us from the nation's capital, Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. Carolyn, good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks, Michael.
And we're discussing how the tax bill will affect Californians. People say there may be a need to be cuts down the line in Medicaid and Social Security to pay for this. You may have some views on that. We've got some experts here with us, and let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. H.D. Palmer is Deputy Director of External Affairs with the California Department of Finance. He joins us this morning. H.D., welcome back to Forum.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Michael.
And we also have in studio Robert Kaplan, who's a partner in Kaplan & Wong CPAs, LLP, and a member of the American Institute of CPAs Individual Tax Committee. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Annette Nellen, who is also here with us in studio. She's professor and director of the Graduate Tax Program at San Jose State University. She's also CPA and chair of the American Institute of CPAs Tax Executive Committee. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have all of you. And H.P. Palmer, let me begin with you. We're going to have an expansion of the deficit here in California. We've got the certainty of large tax increases and spending cuts in the future. The corporations get it perennially. We get it. The cuts ongoing. But we're facing certainly differences here in a number of years, in a question of years. What about the impact of these limits and this deficits just on state and local tax deductions? How does it play out in your mind?
Well, first of all, it creates another level of uncertainty overall in terms of state budgeting, and we can get to that in a minute. I do want to jump back really quickly on a historical point to what Carolyn talked about, and that is that this has been talked about as the most sweeping federal tax reform in more than a quarter of a century, and that's correct that it is. But to give you some perspective, that last reform of the tax system began when then-President Reagan first proposed it in November of 1984, and it took nearly 2 years of review and hearings and debate before it was finally signed into law in October of 1986. Let's compare that to what we're dealing with right now. As Carolyn indicated, it took less than 7 weeks from this bill's first introduction to final passage. It goes into effect in 12 days, and it is going to have huge repercussions that we're going to get into here in a moment. It's far better in terms of the effect not only is going to have on the country, but on nearly 18 million taxpayers in California and a $6 billion plus state economy to have taken the time to have done this right and not rush to meet an arbitrary deadline and the kind of last minute hiccups that you're seeing in terms of technical issues regarding passage.
They wanted it for Christmas.
It's testament to the fact that this has been a very hurried, shape-shifting kind of piece of legislation, and the details matter. And when you're trying to take that short amount of a time to review a bill that totals more than 500 pages of actual legislative text and needs another 560 pages on top of that to explain it, that's irresponsible.
We also have a children's health insurance program, which has not yet been authorized. And we have, I was wondering, as a metaphor for all that scrawling that was going on before the bill went forward, let me bring Annette Helen into this. And Annette Helen, there's so many variables in this. Is it going to be like a postcard for people? That's at least what was promised initially.
No, I don't think people will see a postcard size return. And actually, a majority of individuals e-file their return, so they're probably not focused on the size of it, just what goes into the data. But there's still calculations for, I think, your child credit. And if you're claiming an income tax credit, there's another form. If you're claiming American Opportunity Tax Credit, there's a form for that. So that postcard size return likely actually has a few attachments. But it's not so much, I think, the size of the return. We could have a postcard size return today. It's just how much information do you want on a small piece of paper.
Well, the thing I brought up earlier, and I mentioned, I didn't say the year, the provisions end 2025, and there's much that's subject to change, even in the bill as it's going through now, and it may be passing within before this hour is up. But California may have to change its tax code, don't you think?
Well, today, California conforms to the federal tax laws of January 1st, 2015, with a few variations. But yeah, there's several things I think California will want to take a look at. We don't automatically conform to federal changes, though some states do, and they'll certainly want to take a look at it very quickly. But I think there's some items in the bill that they definitely want to take a look at, because if Congress pulled a few things out, like, oh, there's no more miscellaneous itemized deductions subject to 2% of AGI floor. Well, part of that's a simplification. If you're still tracking them for California purposes, you're still obviously got that complication, though, of course, if it's going to get you a deduction, that can still be good. They've severely cut back the AMT application. So I think some folks in California will say, how come I'm still paying California AMT when I don't pay federal AMT anymore? So they might want some changes there because of complexity. And then the federal will simplify how the, quote, kiddie tax works. And I think people would want to see that same simplification happen in California.
Bob Kaplan, let me go to you about housing supply and demand. I mean, this is going to change. There are new tax laws with respect to mortgages and deductions and all that. It's got to have a major impact.
I would think so. You're going to have a change so that if you have a mortgage, it's called acquisition indebtedness, over $750,000 on a home purchased after December 15th, the interest would not be deductible in excess of $750,000. So that's going to affect people that are buying a house now. And also, because you have an assault limitation of $10,000 either in California tax or property tax, many people will not be able to deduct their property taxes or their state income tax. So I'm not an economist. I can't say what's going to happen in the housing market, but I would say it's not good.
And let me go back to H.D. Palmer, again, as Deputy Director of External Affairs with the California Department of Finance. People going to be leaving the state? They get more bang for their buck in housing and also leaving the state businesses, perhaps? Dan Walters said it's inevitable.
I saw Dan's column just before coming into the studio this morning, and that's been an issue that's been debated for quite some time. What I could point to is that our friends down the road in Palo Alto at Stanford did a study several years ago about whether or not there was a correlation between higher marginal tax rates and what the demographers call out-migration, people moving out of the state. And they used as their example Proposition 63, which the voters in California approved more than a decade ago, that puts a 1% surcharge of incomes over $1 million in California, with the proceeds going to fund mental health services. And the Stanford researchers did not find any positive correlation between that increase in higher marginal rates for upper-income individuals and more people moving out of the state. Oddly, perhaps or ironically, the one thing that they did find correlated to high-income people moving out of California was, of all things, divorce. So I'm not sure that we can necessarily equate it to that, but I do think it does certainly, for not only high-income taxpayers but all taxpayers, creates a huge level of uncertainty that we're all having to deal with. Individuals who are trying to figure out what they can and can't deduct now, payroll companies who are bracing for confusion as they're trying to figure out new withholding rules, and we as a state are trying to figure out or project to what extent this may change our overall picture in terms of state revenue. So it adds, as I said earlier, a new level of uncertainty and some confusion to the process, not only for individuals but for us at the state level as well.
Let me go back to Bob Kaplan, who again is here with us in studio, partner with Kaplan & Wong, CPAs, LLP. Give us a sense, Bob, of what kind of deductions are changing aside from what we're talking about in terms of the big deductions. For example, you're not going to be able to deduct on electric cars anymore, right?
I think the electric car provision was extended in that. I believe that
was it extended?
Got slipped in there at the end.
The credit remains.
So if you talk on the individual side, I already talked about the SALT deduction and the home mortgage deduction. Annette mentioned the 2% limit on miscellaneous itemized deductions. So that's things like your investment fees, your employee business expenses. A lot of people have a lot of unreimbursed employee business expenses. They're no longer deductible. There's a change in personal exemptions up to $2,000 with a phase out, and I believe $1,400 of that is refundable, which means you get it back even if you have no taxes. What I want to stress is that every single person has a different situation, and it's very difficult to eyeball this thing. For example, on Monday, I had six people call me up on the SALT deduction and say, should I prepay my taxes? And every one of the answers was completely different. So I strongly urge the listeners not to guess on this, but to see their professional advisor.
This could be a maddening time for you accountants.
Yeah, we're pretty busy.
I mean, like filing time almost. Yeah. The change in terms of the drop in the corporate tax, you see as being good for business in California.
Yes, I think it should be good for all business. This was a key driver of tax reform at the federal level, was that our corporate system isn't competitive with other countries. They have a much lower rate. They've got what we call a territorial system, where they're only taxing profits earned within that country's borders, where we have a system where we tax worldwide income with some relief through a credit mechanism. But the thought was to make our system more competitive with the other industrialized countries would be good. So far as, you know, a flat 20% rate as opposed to a maximum 35% rate, that should be good for many companies. Today, some companies might be able to get their rates down a little bit little bit lower. That might not be as easy to do. But I think the focus on the corporate scheme and the international competitiveness, I think should prove well so far as helping the economy.
Again, Annette Helen Nellen is professor and director of the graduate tax program at San Jose State University. Let me give out the phone number. We want this to be kind of a clinic of sorts. That is an opportunity for those of you who have questions, whatever they may be, whether business or individual, to bring them forward and see if we can get them answered for you. But also to have you weigh in on this. This is, in many ways, you know, an extraordinary event of its time, whether you're in favor of it or not. It's been decades since we've had anything of this colossal impact, and we do want to hear your thoughts. We've been talking about it certainly off and on now, but now it is fait accompli, or appears to be. So please feel free to join us at our toll-free number. That number to call is 866-733-6786. And if you're listening on Sirius, you can also join us, even though we're kind of narrowing in on California. But we do want to hear your thoughts. 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website with any questions or comments you might have. kqed.org/forum is the way to do that, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and we do welcome your involvement in the program, so please feel free to join us. I'm wondering, H.D. Palmer, a lot of talk about services being cut back inevitably here in California because of this and the likelihood of that, particularly when the provision goes out, but even before that. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, especially on, because there's a lot of talk about marijuana tax, there's talk about, you know, getting rid of Proposition 13, or going back on Proposition 13. Some speculation maybe from you? Or?
I think the speculation, Michael, on the cutbacks probably is coming at the federal level because we're looking at a massive expansion of the deficit by at least $1.4 trillion over 10 years as a result of this bill, as some of the reputable scorekeepers back in Washington have indicated. And that, under the rules of the road of federal budgeting, may very well result in automatic reductions. If it's certified by the Office of Management and Budget that the deficits are large enough that even with continued economic growth, they could entail automatic federal budget reduction cuts of more than $100 billion a year unless those provisions were to be waived by Congress. And that would include cuts of at least several billion dollars per year in California. So again, not specified, unseen, and again, another testament to the fact that we still are determining what the impact of this rather rushed major overhaul is going to be, not only in the short term, but in the long haul as well.
Well, we're coming up on a break, but when we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. And again, feel free to join the program. Annette Nellen and Robert Kaplan are with us in studio. They're both accountants, and they can answer the questions that you may have specifically. But we're also talking about the bigger picture here in the state. H.D. Palmer with us as well, Deputy Director of External Affairs with the Department of Finance here in California. And you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing how the tax bill will affect Californians. And here's David, who writes, the Republican tax bill is a direct attack on the state of California, where taxes will go up for millions. It will become much harder to raise taxes for local projects, and we will all have to pay for a mega giveaway to the 1%. You may want to register your own thoughts or feelings about this. We're inviting your calls, and we're going to go to calls that will involve presumably many questions. In fact, here's one from Stephen. Let me go to you with this. If I may, we have a couple of tax experts with us here in studio, Bob Kaplan and Annette Nellen. Annette, Stephen wants to know, will we be able to prepay the spring installment of our 2018 property tax this month in order to avoid the $10,000 limit on deductions of state, local, and property taxes next year?
Yeah, that's a good question because right, starting 2018, and you itemize, you only deduct a maximum of $10,000 state income tax and property tax combined. If your property tax has been assessed in 2017 and you have the ability just to pay it in 2018, you can pay it in 2017, but you want to make sure it's truly a 2017 liability that was assessed on the property for 2017. So far as prepaying your state income tax of 2018, it's very clear in the legislation you cannot do that. And the logic is that your 2018 income taxes don't exist in 2017. But do watch for the effect of AMT if you're going to prepay your property tax. Again, as Bob was mentioning, you really want to run the numbers to see, are you better off making that real property prepayment or even making your fourth quarter state income tax payment for 2017 to make it in December versus January. Again, run the numbers because many folks will be in AMT and won't get a benefit of it in 2017.
And Bob, a question from Richard. What's the fate of the credit for solar energy installations?
Annette, I didn't see that affected.
That provision, I think, was set to exist through 2021. I think it's going to remain through 2021.
Okay. Bob, let me ask you also about the fact that if there's going to be a mass exodus from California, it's going to be very difficult to establish residency outside of the state. It's not an easy thing to do.
Well, you have to really move. For example, if you have a vacation home in Nevada and you say, oh, on January 1st, I'm going to be a Nevada resident, but you don't document it, the Franchise Tax Board is going to consider you to be a California resident. We give our clients a list of like 20 different items you need to establish residency in another state, such as changing your homeowner exemption, driver's license, voter registration. Also, if you maintain real estate in California as rental, you may have to file a California return on your California source income. So it's a complicated answer.
Let me read one more comment from Robert. It says, why aren't we hearing about how devastating this bill will be for the young who will inherit the danger this bill brings in 8 to 10 years? And that has certainly come up. But now, Robert, you've brought it up again, and I was glad to read your email. Let me go back for a moment, H.D. Palmer, and then we'll start taking calls. H.D., you know, we're in sheer speculation here when we're talking about job creation, for example, or investment effect, not only here in California, but nationally. But the economists in California are much more dubious, much more skeptical, and frankly, a lot less sanguine.
I think that's a fair assessment. Our economists, in looking at this, again, recognizing that the details still have to be combed through in a massive measure like this, are looking at things like the corporate deduction. And if you're looking at corporate profits and the cash that they currently have on hand, corporations are relatively flush with cash at the moment. They're going to receive a significant infusion of cash as a result of this. The question is, what are they going to do with it? There's a lot of belief that there's going to be a lot of use of that newly found profit to buy back stock. Or another one of the provisions of the bill would allow immediate expensing of capital investments, and that may accelerate trends towards automation, which would make job and wage growth even less likely. So from the macro level, I think there is some question as to whether or not the job creation that is associated with the lowering of the corporate rate, which did need to be lowered, but to this extent, people have some questions as to whether or not that, in fact, in the end, is going to generate the kind of job creation that proponents of the measure have advocated and said that it will produce.
Well, we do have a lot of questions, and we'll get to as many of you as we can on the phones here. Let me go first, Lisa, to you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. My question is around specifically more around the real estate implications. We're currently homeowners in Oakland, California, and we were contemplating selling in the spring to get out of the failing Oakland Unified School District. And so I'd like to know how this is going to affect me as a seller, but not only that, but as a potential buyer in the Bay Area if we decide to stay.
Bob Kaplan?
There's really no change in the sale of a principal residence. There was in a earlier version of the bill, but basically if you've used the house as your principal residence for two of the last 5 years, if you're married, you get to exclude up to $500,000 of gain on the house. If you're not married, it's $250,000. Of course, you have to keep track of your improvements on the house. And also, in this tax bill, despite the fact it's 500 pages long, there's really no change to capital gains rates. But before you do a major transaction like sell a house, you should have your accountant crunch the numbers and see what the tax is.
Good luck to you, Lisa. Thank you for your call. We'll go right to another caller, and that's Michael. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. One of your guests mentioned earlier on about moving towards a territorial-based tax. When the big Republican wave just came in, there was a lot of talk about how Paul Ryan wanted to move towards more territorial-based tax. using what was somewhat inappropriately called a border adjustment tax, and that got scrapped. But I keep hearing these brief allusions to the fact that supposedly they have, in fact, made some moves towards more territorial-based tax in this tax bill on the corporate side. And I can't really find any details. So can your guests maybe flesh out how that's going to work?
And that,
most industrialist countries have what they call a territorial system versus a worldwide. Worldwide, all your income, no matter where it's earned, if you're a U.S. corporation, it goes on your corporate tax return. But I don't think any country has a pure territorial because there's always a concern that you're going to shift some profits where you can, like investment income, advertising income, to a tax haven country where they have a very low rate or even a zero rate, which then kind of defeats, you know, still trying to collect tax on a reasonable amount of your income. So there are some backstops to make sure that that doesn't happen in the bill. In fact, actually, the international provisions are fairly complicated. They'll keep their tax accountants busy for some time and their tax attorneys as well. But the, that is the intent to be territorial system. And that is much different than what you'd mentioned on that border adjusted tax. That would have been taking us more to a consumption type approach of tax. But that was dropped in the summer. Instead, they went instead just pure territorial system. But again, there's some prevention of shifting money off to a tax haven.
And let me thank Michael for the call. We'll go to some more calls in just a moment. Let me go first to H.D. Palmer. How do you think, H.D., this is going to go over the Brown administration? How are they going to respond to this and what are they going to do?
Well, I think we have yet to see a lot of the implications of this. A couple of notes. One of the things is Kevin Brady, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, has said that, well, there's clearly going to have to be cleanup legislation, which is a testament to the fact that a lot of the provisions were done in haste. So a lot of the flaws have yet to be determined in this bill or the landmines in it. And there's going to have to be follow-on legislation to address this. So while it is difficult to say with specificity at this point, the major impacts of this, it's fair to say that it creates another layer of uncertainty, and that along with uncertainty over things like Congress's failure to reauthorize the Children's Health Insurance Program, which you mentioned a moment ago, and the issues that are always uncertain, like how's the stock market going to do? How long is our economy going to be expanding? All of those things augur for a prudent approach in the governor's view as he finishes up his work on the budget plan he'll send to the legislature next month. And in doing so, in this environment of added uncertainty with the federal actions and inactions, he's looking at it in two ways. Number one, don't overcommit the state to higher ongoing levels of spending that may not be able to be sustained if the state's fiscal fortunes take a turn in direction for reasons not of our making. And the second thing is, to the greatest extent possible, continue to build up the state's budgetary reserves as a prudent insurance policy against a future economic downturn. One of the things that we've done under Governor Brown is to build up the state's rainy day fund, the so-called budget stabilization account, from zero several years ago to $8.5 billion now. Clearly not enough to mitigate all of the potential bad effects of an economic downturn, but certainly a move in the right direction. Contrast that, if you will, with the fact that the measure that is about to be signed into law would expand the federal deficit by about $1.4 trillion over the next 10 years. So I think it is fair to observe that, at least in terms of future prudence, California and the nation as a whole seem to be moving in opposite directions, with California moving to be prudent on the budgeting side and putting away more in reserves for a rainy day, as opposed to the direction we're seeing, broadly speaking, with this tax measure.
Again, we're discussing how the tax bill will affect California and Californians. And here is another caller, Sushila. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. The question I had, two questions I had was, will the non-deduction of state and property taxes be offset by the increase in the AMT tax rate? And the second question is, will we be able to deduct any amount taken from the 529 plan to be spent on K-12 education?
All right, we can go to our two in-studio guests here, Bob and Ned. We can take one or the other.
Well, one of the calculations I was doing on Monday was to see whether there was any benefit in prepaying the state and local income taxes, property taxes. And as you said, the alternative minimum tax has an impact on that. Alternative minimum tax is a separate tax calculation. I describe it as an iceberg. You see it when it's above the water. So when it's higher than the regular tax, it applies. Under the old law, the big things that got people into AMT were the state and local income taxes. So some of my clients that were saying, should I prepay state taxes? Should I prepay property taxes? They were in AMT in 2017. It didn't help them at all. And in 18, they're under this $10,000 limitation. It won't help them either. So they get no benefit out of either one of them. Now, there is an AMT for 2018 and onward, but it's not going to apply to very many people because the major reason for most of my clients being in AMT is the SALT deduction.
Want to say something here on that?
Yeah, and starting in 2018, you still have the SALT deduction adjustment for AMT, but it can't be more than $10,000 because you can only deduct $10,000. Another AMT adjustment some folks have is that you can't deduct for AMT purposes the interest on your home equity debt on your home. But that won't be deductible going forward for regular tax, so there won't be any AMT adjustment for that.
And then, Nellen, listen.
Michael, I wouldn't presume to give any personal income tax advice, but I can provide a little bit of broad context based on some historical tax data. If you look at the 2015 tax year in California, the most recent comprehensive data that we've got, about 6 million California tax returns, roughly one out of every three, claim the so-called SALT deductions or state and local property tax, including millions of middle-income Californians who may not benefit from the increased standard deduction. And as noted, while allowing up to a $10,000 deduction on property taxes and income taxes provides some offset, again, looking at the historical data, more than 80% of state income tax and property tax deductions exceed that $10,000 limit. And the average deduction for state and local income taxes, according to the historical data alone, was nearly about $16,000 per return, while the state and local property taxes averaged about $6,000 per return. So, again, a major shift in issues affecting roughly one out of every three Californians dealt with in legislation that went from start to finish in less than 7 weeks.
Let me go to more calls. Paul, join us. Welcome.
Hello. I would like to know what the guests think about the very nice gift that was presented by the legislature to Trump and Senator Corker regarding the pass-through real estate businesses.
Yeah, this was this gets us away from California, but there was a provision put in which helps real estate moguls. Bob Corker, former senator, I said former, he's not going to run again, but he's still a senator of Tennessee who was opposed to this bill. It's caused a whole controversy because he came aboard, he was against the bill, and then he suddenly was with the bill, and people are saying it's because of that provision. He said he didn't read the provision. He even asked Senator Orrin Hatch to please tell him what the provision was because he hadn't been informed. So we get into a real thicket here, kind of a miasma, if you will. But I think if anybody wants to weigh in on it, please go ahead. I didn't want to necessarily steer us away from California, but there are real estate moguls in California,
right,
too.
Right.
Well, I think, Michael, that without getting into the politics that are involved with the issue that your caller brings up, I think that is illustrative of the fact that a complex bill of this size and this scope and this huge impact is going to have a lot of things like this come up in a short amount of time because there was, as having worked on Capitol Hill for a number of years back, longer ago than I'd care to cop to publicly, when you move a bill like this that quickly in Washington, people tend to try to be able to put in certain provisions. And
you used to call them riders, HB, remember?
They used to, yeah, back in the old days, they used to call them riders. You're absolutely right, Mike. But again, compared to the last comprehensive tax reform, which took nearly 2 years to carefully deliberate and to review and to examine the impact of it, this type of stuff is going to come up in a very compressed time frame. We saw it, leaving aside this provision that the caller brought up, you saw a number of different provisions change in between when the House passed its initial version of the bill And then when the Senate passed it, and then when it came to a two-House conference committee, which is why I was referring to it as kind of a shape-shifting organism because it kept changing every time we tried to do an analysis of it, there were a number of any brand-new provisions that totally changed, you know, the way we were looking at the bill.
Well, we said earlier there was repeal of the Affordable Care Act individual mandate. There was also Alaska National Wildlife Refuge now is open for oil drilling and other things that we probably don't have time to get to here, but we do have time to get to some of your comments, and let me do that. A listener writes, what in the tax bill prevents large corporations from keeping profits overseas? Will we find ourselves in the same place in 10 years? You want to handle that, HD?
Well, again, I would go to some of what the corporations themselves are saying. If you look at what CNBC did a survey last week of what they call their Global Council of Chief Financial Officers, and they said, asked the question of chief financial officers of these corporations, what group stands to benefit most from the tax plan if it becomes law? And they were very clear about it. These chief financial officers, these corporations said half of the 50% said the benefit's going to go to large corporations, whereas 12.5% said middle-class individuals and just over 8% went to small businesses. So, again, leaving aside the politics of it, there's been discussion on both sides of the aisle that a lowering of the corporate tax rate was something that was something that needed to be done. The question is, to the extent that it has been lowered to this rate, and the arguments that by lowering it to the rate that it's been lowered to, 21%, that it's going to generate this kind of economic and job creation, you know, is something that is about to be tested in the real world as we see how these provisions play out in the economy.
I think earlier today, Senator Schumer said that about 2% of the people are getting 98% of the benefits. That's at least how he crunched the numbers. Question, Annette Nellen from a listener who wants to know, what is expected to happen to charitable contributions with the new tax bill?
Well, there's no change to charitable contributions, no appreciable change. There's a few, I think, relatively minor ones, but you could still deduct your charitable contributions. But with a higher standard deduction, many individuals will find that they're going to claim the standard deduction as opposed to itemized deduction. So it then makes if you're making charitable contributions mainly for tax purposes and you're taking the standard deduction, you won't get it. Added deduction for the charitable contributions. And charities have raised that issue with the higher standard deduction that it might have an impact on charitable contributions, though many people still make charitable contributions today when they itemize.
And here's more of our callers. We go to Peter. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. There are a lot of people on low incomes or limited incomes who may pay no taxes or very little in taxes, and for them there will be zero benefit as far as I can tell. In terms of fairness, they're not benefiting in any way, and yet the country is going into debt. And later on, when it comes to cutting benefits, they're the ones whose benefits, if they have any, are going to be cut. So I'm wondering how many people are earning money or getting money but not paying any taxes or maybe very low taxes. How many of those people are there?
Can you shed some light on that for Peter, H.D. Palmer?
I don't have the metrics on the number of individuals who don't pay tax. I will note, though, to the caller's point, that Governor Brown and the legislature have worked to try to move more towards dealing with the issues of poverty by doing things like adopting the first ever state-only earned income tax credit that is designed primarily to provide economic benefit to those at the lower end of the income scale or who are in the kind of circumstances that the caller describes, as well as to ensure that there is, you know, an adequate social safety net. But again, as I indicated earlier, depending upon how Congress and the scorekeepers in Washington view the deficit and whether or not those deficit projections would trigger automatic federal budget cuts that could very well affect some of the entitlement programs, that impact remains to be seen.
And let me thank Peter for his call and go right to another caller, and that's Pat. Pat, you're on.
Hi. I just have one question about this.
I don't know what's happening with your phone there. We got a bad connection, I think. Let me get another caller on here. We'll go to Wynn next. Wynn, go ahead.
Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. We seem to be having a little roulette here with the phones. This is Daniel, I believe. Go ahead.
This is Daniel. Yeah, yeah. Daniel from San Jose. Okay. My question, and I haven't heard a really great answer on this, is the 529K, if you contribute into a program like that for private education, kindergarten through 12th grade, if they can answer, is it just that you get the gain from the accounts and you're not taxed on the gain? In other words, you're not able to put it in before tax. You're only able to use the money that you're making from the account towards private school besides college.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Daniel. We'll go to Bob Kaplan.
Wasn't that the part that was eliminated last night?
I think you want to take a careful look because then there was something related to homeschooling that was eliminated, but there also was a modification that they would allow for contributions to 529 plans for private K-12 education. I don't know if that got dropped at the last minute. So worth a check on that.
I thought it was still in there, but who knows? I mean, like you said, this was a thing going in motion. Constantly.
Yeah, this is a last minute, even after the House voted on yesterday.
If I could, Michael, I think what the discussion you just heard in between Bob and Annette and the caller is illustrative of a rushed process. We've got a caller who is trying to figure out the investment and tax implications of his children's education. And we still don't know the final answer to what the tax treatment is going to be because of the last-minute changes in a bill that is massive in scope and light on consideration.
Let me thank the caller. I hope we can maybe get some more light on that before the hour is finished. But at this point, it looks like it's going to go through. That is, the bill is going to go through, and we'll see it, I hope, without writing in the margins or scrawlings or whatever. But here's a suggestion by a listener. It says, businesses are getting a reduction in taxes, thus keeping more of their profits, which they claim will trickle down to workers. Wouldn't this be the time to raise the minimum wage so workers don't have to wait until it trickles? We'll let that stand, and we'll take another caller. And that's you, Steve. Good morning.
Hi. My wife and I have three properties, two in California, one in Oregon. And my question is regarding the $10,000 in property tax exclusions, deductions. Is that combined or is that a cap on each property?
Yeah, Bob Kaplan.
Well, a rental property is not included in this SALT limitation. So you would fill out Schedule E for the rental property, rental income and expenses, and include your full property taxes. This limit on SALT is only for a principal residence and a vacation home.
Thank you, Steve, for the question. And Helen wants to add something?
Yeah. If they are all vacation homes, then it is a maximum aggregate $10,000 limit, including your state income tax, not per property.
Here's Wynn. Wynn, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about the deficit. I think the problem is that Congress has focused on the $1.5 trillion. But that's on top of what we would expect to have normally for the next 10 years, which, if you look at the last 10 years, was $8 trillion. So we're really talking about an increase of potentially $5 to $10 trillion over the next 10 years. I don't know how we're going to pay that, because if you look back since the World War II, there have only been 11 years out of the last 74 in which there's been a not a deficit in the budget.
H.D., you want to comment on Wynn's number crunching there?
Well, again, I can just go back to what the scorekeepers have said, looking at this measure alone, which is that it would expand the deficit by at least $1.4 trillion over 10 years on top of what the existing deficit is now. Again, at the state level, we're trying to move in the opposite direction. The governor started out with a $27 billion budget gap when he came into office in 2011, and we've been able to bring that back into balance through a number of different steps and an improved economy. And we're putting away more and more of the state's benefits from a improved economy into a budget reserve so that we don't have to have the kind of devastating cuts in an economic downturn in the future that we saw as recently as 2008 during the Great Recession, and then back in 2001 when the dot-com boom in California, which everybody thought was going to go on forever, went spectacularly bust. We don't, to the extent that we can avoid seeing that movie again in California, we don't want to.
Let me thank the caller, Wynn, and go on to Colleen. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I have a comment and a question. My comment is that Nancy Pelosi should be ashamed of herself for selling out the California taxpayers and not doing anything to fight against this. She thinks she's going to score political points in 2018, and meanwhile, some of us are going to be hammered by this tax increase. I personally am going to pay an increase, and that means I'll spend less with small businesses that I currently support, and they're going to feel the impact. My question is around AMT. So I pay AMT, and I understand that ultimately that means my income is assessed a tax at 28%. My income tax rate is going to go up to 32% in 2018 under the new tax tables. And I understand the AMT threshold is going to go up, so I will no longer be hit by AMT. I'm wondering if you're, which actually would be a benefit if I was going to be taxed at 28% under AMT. So I wonder if your experts know what the new AMT thresholds will be.
Well, yeah, the AMT system currently has an exemption where if your income's below that, you won't owe any AMT because it's meant to affect higher income individuals. They are increasing that. I think it's roughly, I think, 73,000 exemption if you're single, and I think 110,000 if you're married, which is quite favorable. And those won't phase out if you have higher income unless you have over $1 million of income. If you do find you're going to be on a 32% rate and the AMT rates are going to stay at 26 and 28, and there'll be fewer adjustments to your AMT, right? You're only going to have a $10,000 state income tax adjustment. You might not owe AMT going forward.
Let me thank the caller and announce that just minutes ago the House did pass the Republican tax reform bill, so it is indeed in cement, at least for now. We'll continue to follow it, obviously. Extend thanks to H.D. Palmer from the Department of Finance, to Robert Kaplan from Kaplan & Wong, CPAs, LLP, and Annette Nelson, Professor and Director of the Graduate Tax Program at San Jose State University. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum. Michael Ellis will be joining us in the hour ahead. We're going to talk about all things in the world of nature, fauna, flora, and more. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.